Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is local musician and composer Jared Johnson. Johnson is best known for his work as a drummer with any number of local bands and musicians. Incredibly versatile, Johnson is at home playing adventurous jazz with both local and nationally known jazz artists, playing for local shows, or playing Western swing with the Tulsa Playboys. But Johnson also writes music, and over the past 4 years has been working on a project inspired by John Steinbeck's novel, The Grapes of Wrath. The project is a collection of original compositions inspired by characters and passages from the classic novel that has stayed with Johnson over the years. Here's a tune inspired by Tom Joad's classic dialogue, "Wherever there's a fight so hungry people can eat, I'll be there." That's the music of Jared Johnson's The Grapes of Wrath project. The music with his band Next of Kin, featuring a who's who of local musicians, is now a recording project. And Jared Johnson is my guest today. Jared Johnson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
It's a pleasure to have you on, and congratulations on this new album, The Grapes of Wrath project. How did this project get started?
Well, I've been a big fan of John Steinbeck, all his works, but The Grapes of Wrath is sort of my favorite novel, and I've read it multiple times. And I was, for a while, had been trying to come up with an idea for a solo album, something that I could feature my drumming and composition. And I had done a couple of projects for a church that I used to direct music for, but it was all church music, and I didn't really have an artifact that represented kind of what I'm doing now as a composer. So I wasn't exactly sure how to approach it. I knew what I didn't want it to be. I didn't want to do a, you know, just an album of jazz standards or whatever. I wanted to maybe concentrate more on my writing. But up to this point, you know, most of my writing, you know, it just sounded like assignments, you know, just exercises. Mm-hmm. And so I think once I had the idea to focus on this thematic element, the creativity really opened up for me. And it was really honestly like an epiphany. It just occurred to me, what if I married sort of the love of the literature with writing some original music? And it seemed like it made so much sense. And I just felt like, what a great idea, you know? And then once I had the focus and the theme, it seemed like the writing became a little easier for me.
Yeah. And in full disclosure, I should say that you and I have played many a musical engagement together. And I've always thought of you as the glue. You know, you're just one of these great musicians that sort of glues together any sort of collection of musicians and makes everybody sound a lot better.
Wow.
And I love that about your playing. But I was totally blown away when I saw that you were putting this project together. I said, well, this is a whole nother side of Jared I've never seen before.
Right. That was the endeavor, you know, to sort of let people know that I want to write. I have ideas. I want to concentrate on that aspect of my musicality, you know, not just the playing. Because, you know, as you know, I mean, I'm a sideman and I'm in multiple projects all the time, backing up other people in shows and for just gigs, dances, whatever. But I wanted to do something that was more representative of a personal thing for me.
Yeah. And The Grapes of Wrath was that project. What is it about this that speaks to you? Because, you know, when you hear this music, you go, well, this is not depression. This is very contemporary, modern jazz. But what is it about the project that speaks to you in your musical vocabulary?
Well, again, full disclosure, I mean, I know that there have been plays and even musical projects done on The Grapes of Wrath. It was a challenge to do it without lyrics to basically try to convey emotional ideas and to evoke emotional responses with just music. And this is another part of it. You know, I'm already in a lot of groups that play for dancing, you know, but this is not dance music per se. You know, it's not bebop. It's not funk music. I would like to think that it's a little more introspective. Maybe it's a little darker. It's music to sort of sit and listen to. And The Grapes of Wrath as a work, I think, just speaks to me. I can relate to sort of the rural sensibilities of these Oklahoma farmers, and then just sort of the universal idea of being oppressed and then having this defiant optimism to overcome it, you know, I think is a timeless theme. So that was really a driving force, you know, and just what was inspiring, you know, the next step in the creative process. And also spiritually, you know, it didn't occur to me the first few times that I read it, but as I've matured and been able to understand it better, the character, the preacher, Jim Casey, mm-hmm. really resonates, you know, because I really embrace now this idea of the collective soul of man. And the other line, which there was a tune that didn't make it onto the project from the narrative, which is "All that lives is holy." These are also things that were really indelibly sort of scratched into me, you know, and so I hope that maybe the spirit of that comes out a little bit as well.
Yeah. Were the tunes something you adapted for the project, or were these tunes, did they come out of the project? You know, like the very first tune on the album is called Land Turtle, which refers to this little digression in the book, mm-hmm. The very first chapters where a turtle's trying to cross the road, and it's going across the road, and then a car runs into it. He narrowly misses one car, and then another car purposely bumps into it and knocks him on his back, and slowly but surely climbs back up the shoulder of the highway.
It's a great metaphor.
Yeah, you know. So was that, when you were writing the tune, were you thinking of that incident?
Yeah. You know, some of the lines, sort of the melodies and things, mm-hmm. I had some sketches of some things that I had just set aside, and some of that stuff I was able to sort of pull out and go, hey, you know, maybe this might work in the context of what we're doing. And so a few things kind of took on a new life, and then I was able to really follow through with those ideas, you know, with the new focus. But a lot of the melodic and harmonic structures sort of came together just as I was doing it. It was a long process to put this together. I think I wrote for about maybe a year and a half. So I spent a lot of time just sitting at the piano and picking out, you know, because I mean, I'm a very rudimental piano player, you know, but that's where I write. I write at the guitar a little bit, but primarily at the piano. And so just picking out melodies, and it's amazing, you know, it's for me, I mean, I can only speak to my own process, but it's amazing how many times, you know, I'll be working on an idea and I'll never really be quite happy with it. But then, you know, it'll just always come together and it'll be like, that's what I was looking for, you know? Mm-hmm. So I may not always get there quickly, but I will eventually get there. And so I learned a lot about just the process of composition doing this. But to answer your question, those thematic elements in the book, you know, completely informed sort of what I was trying to accomplish, you know, because it's not music unto itself. I mean, I am trying to sort of tell a story. I like to say that they're songs, not just tunes. And so even though that they don't have the lyrical element, I am trying to convey an emotion, you know, and as I said, evoke maybe a response. And I don't want to project too much onto the listener. I want people to sort of have their own thoughts and feelings about this. But from where I'm coming from, you know, I'm definitely setting out to paint a picture, you know, and using the book as kind of my canvas, I guess.
Of course, on that tune, the Land Turtle, you're using Steve Hamm's plunger muted trombone. I assume that just sort of evokes this idea of this plodding turtle.
These musicians are all some of my best friends, some of the best pickers in town, as you know, and I specifically assembled this cast for their individual personalities, you know, what I knew that they would bring to the project, not just musically, but just, you know, their personalities, mm-hmm. what kind of people. I wanted to get them together in a studio or on a stage and just see what would transpire. And I wasn't disappointed. I think my instincts were right on this. And when Ham came in with the plunger, I mean, I had heard him work that plunger before, and so when I wrote the melody to Land Turtle, I mean, I immediately heard him, and so I was like, Ham, bring the plunger, you know, this is going to be the sound, you know. And so I remember in the studio, you know, he was just like, you know, I was making that turtle talk, you know, and I was like, you're right, you know, you nailed it. So
now,
it's great.
Now, you obviously know the story very intimately in writing the music. Did you try to convey that to your musicians when they are performing, say, when somebody's doing the tune Ma, about Ma Joe, the matriarch that keeps the family together?
I didn't assume very much, except that I probably figured that I'll just tell you that the only person that is more geeked out about Steinbeck that I've met personally than me is John Woolley, you know? And so I did not want to assume that anybody would be, you know, so passionate about the subject matter, maybe as I was. But I tried to get, you know, everybody on board with, you know, so here's what's happening, you know, here's kind of the mood we're going for. Everybody was really into it, you know, and even if they weren't as familiar necessarily with that specific, you know, part of the narrative, you know, it seems like they were willing to learn, or they were willing to sort of enter into it. And I think that speaks volumes to, like, how unselfish and mature these musicians are, you know, they giving completely of themselves to this idea of mine. And really, standing alone, these tunes are actually kind of simple, but these guys, they just brought so much passion to it, and just brilliant improvising, and I couldn't be happier.
Well, since we've talked a little bit about the Land Turtle, why don't we hear a little bit of that so you can get the sense of that. This is from Jared Johnson's new album, The Grapes of Wrath Project, with Jared Johnson and Next of Kin, a really fine band. Here is a little bit of Land Turtle. Music by my guest today, Jared Johnson, and Next of Kin, his new album, The Grapes of Wrath Project, and a tune called Land Turtle, which featured Steve Ham on the plunger driven trombone, if you will. And Jared's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Now, you mentioned John Woolley a moment ago, and John has been your narrator, narrating portions of The Grapes of Wrath when you've done live gigs. And actually, we should take it back a little step. You've talked about how long you were spent writing this project, but this actual album is a sort of a labor of love as well. Because the first performance, and I assume that was what you were gearing up for, was back in 2015 during, I guess it was the Summer Fringe Festival in the Guthrie area, Guthrie Green area. You did it at Woody Guthrie Center, right?
Yeah, that was originally going to be part of the summer stage that year, and then this Fringe Festival came about, which is held in many cities, and at the time Tulsa was trying to get something like that going. So it was for maybe artists and acts that maybe could perform in a smaller venue for more intimate settings, and there were several theaters that were used as satellite locations that year for the festival, and Woody Guthrie Center just seemed like a really good fit for what we were doing. And so even before the project was completed, when it was still just kind of germinating, I had talked to John and Woolley about it, and from, you know, instantly, just was, he was like all on board with this idea, you know. And I personally was just completely gratified that he agreed to be part of it. He has been very supportive throughout the whole process, you know, and just really brought a level of professionalism to it. Because I said that no one is as geeked out about Steinbeck that I know personally as John, but I mean, I say that with respect. I consider him an authority on these things, and so for him to step in and kind of help us out with this was made me feel really good, you know. Yeah. It felt like an endorsement that maybe I was going in the right direction with this idea.
Right. And as I mentioned, you know, it doesn't have this 30s feel at all. It's very contemporary jazz, yet there's something in it that does evoke it. And what's really amazing about this project is you have this without the readings, which goes along with a live performance. What went behind the decision not to have the readings? Was it just a matter of getting rights from the Steinbeck estate?
Primarily. It was kind of a double-edged sword. I mean, I didn't really want to wade into the whole logistical
and this is
legal
self-produced.
Thing.
This is a self-produced project.
It's independent.
Anyway.
Yeah. And I felt on the one hand, I didn't want to get bogged down in, you know, what exactly we would be entitled to do on a recording. But the other element is I want these songs to be able to stand alone as well as in sort of a suite that we're presenting. Because at some point, you know, I would like to take the band out to not only play the show, but just to play shows where we could do some more of my original music, which I'm still working on. And so, like, since we finished the Grapes of Wrath project and really getting the whole thing on a CD has given me a little bit of closure for this, because as I told you earlier, it's kind of like an egg that I've been sitting on for a really long time. It was like a year and a half or so to compose the thing and then rehearse it, then, you know, to initially debut the show. And we've done a couple of more since then around town. But then to finally get the music recorded and then the process of raising the cash to actually, you know, get the thing packaged and everything, it's been, as we said, a labor of love, but and I do love it, but I'm kind of ready to kind of say, okay, here's the end product, here's the artifact, and then I feel that it frees me up a little bit to continue pursuing other things from here.
Yeah. There's a number of tunes that go along with important quotes. So there's obviously a tune that goes along with Tom Joad, "I'll Be There," you know, the famous speech that, you know, Henry Fonda made so famous. But I want to ask about one tune, which I really loved on the album. It's called "Joe Davis's Boy." And this is a pretty minor story, I think, in the in the whole plot. And yet when I heard that, I said, oh, wait a minute, there may be another story here.
Well, that could be. I mean, your listeners may not know the name Joe Davis, but he was my instructor at Northeastern there in Tahlequah. And
an amazing musician.
Brilliant, genius musician. I know that you played a lot with him, and anybody that's still around Tulsa that's, you know, at least a certain age probably is aware of Joe's contribution just to the local music scene and just to music as far as we're concerned in general. But this was a little bit of a nod to him.
Right. Because you are one of Joe's boys.
That's what I kind of like to think of it that way. It's a kind of
he would claim you.
it's kind of a double, you know, kind of narrative there. But you know, as you were saying, I think Steinbeck calls those general chapters, where there's you know, maybe an aside from the story, and so these things tend to maybe just address, you know, economic issues or you know, agricultural issues, but they don't really have specific characters. Yeah, but in that chapter, they mention Joe Davis's boy, who is, as you said, a minor character, but Joe Davis's boy is someone who was driving one of the Caterpillar tractors that the bank had dispatched to, you know, basically drive these people off their land, knock down their house, you know. And the first several times I read the book, I didn't even really, you know, recognize the name. And so
you're just upset, you know,
I guess.
And then you realize that,
wait a minute,
Joe Davis's boy is basically taking care of his family. That's the only job he can get.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's what Steinbeck's point was.
And so, yeah, it's kind of there's a dilemma there, a moral dilemma, and it helps you to see, you know, all the sides of the story. But the fact that this character's name was Joe Davis's boy just resonated, you know, so I've got to do something with that. To be honest, I think the track was originally going to be called Caterpillars. I've read this book so many times, but when I was really getting ready to do the project, I went back through specifically to highlight maybe important phrases or descriptors, and well, that jumped out at me, and I was like, that's the name of this tune.
All right, well, let's hear a little bit of that by Jared Johnson and Next of Kin from the Grapes of Wrath project, Joe Davis's Boy. Mm-hmm. music by my guest today, musician and drummer Jared Johnson, from his new album, The Grapes of Wrath Project. And why don't we tell everybody about who's on this? We mentioned Steve Hamm a moment ago, but tell us about the band.
Okay. On saxophones is Mike Cameron, who is known around town. He hustles a lot. He has a lot of gigs going on. And I play in probably two or three groups that he has. He's got a big band that I play in, and it's some of his small groups. He calls it a collective, which is like a revolving door of pretty much everybody in town. But I've been playing with Mike for maybe, we were talking the other day, maybe almost 8 years. And then also Scott McQuaid is another person in that group that has played with Mike a lot. So I think the first time I ever played with Mike, Scott was on the gig. And so we all kind of have a history. And Scott and I, you know, we have a rapport musically. We're almost into that uncomfortable place where we're reading each other's minds so much that we're constantly playing the same thing, and which isn't very cool. You know, it sounds like we're trying to be cute, and we're not. But both brilliant musicians, and then of course Steve Hamm bringing some soulfulness with the trombone. Isaac Eicher plays electric mandola on the recording,
and it's not mandolin, a mandola.
It's a mandola. It's a little bit of a different animal, as I'm learning. And I met Isaac through his dad Shelby, who I work for in the Tulsa Playboys. And Isaac played mandolin on some of those gigs a couple of years ago. But I got to know him a little bit on some road trips that we did. And when I started talking about the project to him, he seemed intrigued, and I liked the idea of bringing an electric mandola as opposed to just an electric guitar. It seemed the timbre of that instrument was unique and sort of a folk sound, but also modern. And I was really interested to see what would happen, like, for example, to compose a unison line and have that sound come from a tenor saxophone, a trombone, and an electric mandola, sort of, you know, all playing the unison part there. And it really is an interesting texture. And so Isaac is he's brilliant, you know, he really inspires me. He was not able to record with us in the studio. He's the only person that had to sort of multi-track, and he did his tracks in Nashville, and then just sort of sent them in. And then Jim Lofton, who was also one of Joe Davis's boys, he and I go way back, and he's kind of my soul brother. He's kind of my partner in crime or whatever, rhythmically.
Wonderful bass player.
Yeah, he's brilliant and the most understated, but certainly the most mature, you know, musician for what he's doing. And so I was really pleased that he was really excited to be part of this. I feel like it's a very unique crew cast. You know, everyone has their own strengths. Everyone's coming from maybe a slightly different place, but there's a synergy there that I'm really proud of how the whole thing came out.
Well, it's some really wonderful music, and it's obviously, you know, when you just look at the titles, you know, you've spent a long time with this novel. Do you feel like there's one tune that perhaps comes closest to capturing the feeling of the novel and what you were able to put on paper?
I think if I was going to, in terms of mood, I think the tune that probably maybe is the most evocative is Ma, because she's sort of she's really the head of the family, you know, and it's really in the story. It's her, I don't want to say optimism necessarily, but it's her hope, you know, and it's her strength that really keeps the family
steely,
going throughout.
Steely determinist.
I think so. Yeah, yeah. That's a good way to say it.
Yeah.
And it's really hard reading the book sometimes to not see the faces from the
film,
you know. And so I tried to not do that a little bit. I tried to maybe try to conjure in my mind my own
family,
sort of character sketches, you know, but I kept coming back to those portrayals in the movie. And I think that, you know, your question was if there was a song that maybe encapsulated the whole sort of concept, I think Ma comes pretty close. It's a simple tune, but I think in terms of just mood and the way everyone plays on this thing, I think it comes pretty close.
Yeah. So is there any plans to continue to do a couple more performances with the release of the CD?
Now that the CD's out, it has really freed me up to kind of promote it a little better. So I'm in talks with several venues trying to get some things happening. And
of course, your band is so busy.
That's the other problem.
It's like all of them are band leaders in one way or another.
Everyone has their own band, and everybody's is doing their own thing. So it's a real challenge, you know, to try to get everybody on the same page. Maybe try to find a night when everyone is available to play shows. I mean, and then the fact that Isaac, you know, is in Nashville now, and he's doing a lot of touring. So it's just trying to get everybody lined up. But when it happens, you know, it's a special thing. So just kind of stay tuned, and I'll try to keep you posted. But we've got several things kind of, we're right on the brink of booking a couple of things here pretty quick, I hope.
Now, I assume the CD is both available, I'm sure, online in a downloadable format, but also probably local locations around town.
Right. You can find the streaming at all the, it's on like every streaming site, like the Spotify and the mm-hmm. Pandora. And then if you want to download a copy, it's going to be at like Amazon, iTunes, and like CD Baby. I think you can order a physical copy from them. And if you want a physical copy, you know, you can come to a gig that I'm at and come and see me and I'll sell you one. Or I've got some at the coffee house on Cherry Street there and at like Josie Records and mm-hmm. different places around town. I'm trying to kind of get them stocked so people can see it. And I stream music, but I download music, but I still listen to cassettes. You know, I like to have the artifact, you know. So if people still like to have their own CD, you know, just come and find me.
Well, the name of the project is the Grapes of Wrath Project, with my guests today, Jared Johnson, Mike Cameron, Isaac Eicher, Steve Hamm, Scott McQuaid, and Jim Lofton, putting together some really amazing music. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. We wish you luck with the project.
Thank you.
We'll look forward to maybe having another Grapes of Wrath concert at some point.
Sure.
And why don't we go out with Ma? So, Jared, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich.
Jazz musician Jared Johnson speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Jared Johnson and Next of Kin's new album is titled The Grapes of Wrath Project. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher.